person in there, because everyone else.
Yes.
Okay, good, all right.
It's crazy.
The House Committee on Revenue for February 18th, 2015 will come to order. Thank you all for attendance. We open the information meeting, Department of Revenue overview and update on the core systems replacement. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the planning for this week's calendar with the meeting, the chair and vice chairs discussed the need to have an overview of the Department of Revenue. We've had some discussion around administration of the individual programs, particularly the personal income tax and the property tax, but we asked Jim Buchholz, the director, to be here to give you an overview. After that, we'll go into specific discussion around the core system replacement project, which, of course, the department's is well underway on.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jim Buchholz, director of your Department of Revenue. Last week, John Phillips and Deanna Mack of our office gave you an overview of the Department of Revenue from the program and function level. And today, I am going to give you an overview, but from a different angle. And specifically, I'm going to give you a sneak peek of the things that we're queuing up at the other end of the building in Ways and Means. And these will give you a little bit of insight, I think, as to what we hope to be working on over the next couple of years. I put this slide in as a reminder of why we exist and what is driving our current transformation at the Department of Revenue. To the mission first, we are at the Department of Revenue simultaneously the least important agency in state government and the most important agency in state government. We're the least important because we don't deliver services directly to Oregonians, but we're the most important because without us, nobody else does either. And so we think that we're in a kind of a unique spot in state government in that way. But we're very aware of our mission at the Department of Revenue and the things that the work that we do supports. The vision that you see there is what's driving our current transformation effort at DOR. We realize that we have no shot of being a model of anything with the outdated tools and the outdated business processes that we've been working with, and so that's really what's been driving our transformation here recently. This is a list of the policy option packages that will be queuing up at the other end of the building, as I said, next month. And I thought I'd discuss each of them, and that we'll talk about where we're going with it. The first one here is the core system replacement project. It's a familiar project and a familiar topic to Revenue Committee veterans. I won't talk too much on it because we've got a couple of folks. We've got Eric Smith of our office, who's the project director, and a couple of other people who are ready to speak specifically to the benefits and the things that the system will bring to us and how well the system implementation is going. But what I do want to talk to you about or just mention here is a reminder of the enormity of the project to the Department of Revenue. And I have an ask of you this biennium. Last year, we successfully converted the cigarette tax, the other tobacco products, and the corporation excise tax programs. My concern is that when people hear that this was a commercial off-the-shelf system, so something that was already working in other states, and they hear about the success that we had in implementing, that they think, okay, well, this was a walk in the park for the Department of Revenue. This was something that was very simple, like sitting down in front of your computer, sticking in a disk of Microsoft Office, and hitting install and walking away. But nothing really could be the further from the truth for us. This was a monumental effort for the Department of Revenue between configuration, data cleansing, testing and training, and all of the other activities that go to a successful system implementation. We spent somewhere north of 120,000 person hours in implementing this system. It consumed nearly all of our discretionary resource. And so if we get funded for the next 2 years, we will be implementing the personal income tax program, which has more accounts than any other account that we have. And it's the big dog. It's the big enchilada for the Department of Revenue in the state of Oregon. That's where the bulk of our resources come from. So we have to get that right. And then following that, in the next year, is the withholding program, which has the bulk of the dollars that come through. And so this year and the next will be an even bigger stretch for the Department of Revenue than this last year was. So the ask that I have of you is that just as last session, when you worked with us on the 911 program, that where we added prepaid wireless and moved it to a point of sale, you worked with us as to timing on that, and that was really very helpful. We were able to delay it a year as to what you originally wanted, how you originally wanted to implement it, so that it fit in with our system implementation schedule, and it really didn't cause us any problem at all. As you have ideas, or if you hear your colleagues that have ideas that may potentially impact the Department of Revenue, the ask is that you work with us to identify a good timing for it so that it doesn't compete with the same resources that we need to be able to implement the system. So that's core system replacement. The next one is PIT refund fraud, personal income tax refund fraud. This is a growing problem for all states and the IRS. This graph shows the recent history of fraud attempts in Oregon. It's growing, and it's growing exponentially. And what's more, the nature of the attempts are changing as well. Old school fraud was somebody sitting down and altering their W-2 or fudging on their deductions. Now, the most fraud attempts are connected with identity theft, and they're more sophisticated. So people will steal an identity, and what they'll do is they'll file ahead of time. They'll file before the legitimate person files and try to get their refund. We're getting better at detecting them, I would say, detecting the fraud attempts, but the attempts are also increasing. So fraudsters are getting more sophisticated, too, in what they're doing. There's evidence, I think, at least anecdotal evidence, that they're figuring out the state's business rules, and I don't mean just Oregon. I mean all states have business rules that they put in place to be able to filter for these fraud attempts. And they're changing their methods to try to circumvent those business rules. There's also evidence that they go where...
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Whitson?
I have a comment regarding that. We had a former state senator who, when we file for office, we have to sign a form with our signatures, and it's on the Internet. And we have a former state senator. It's my understanding that somebody took that right off the Internet, off from the Secretary of State's office, and stole their identity from that. And it's something I'm very concerned about. Somebody pointed out to me, if you pull up my name, my signature comes up first thing, and it's right off from the Secretary of State's office. So, I mean, I think all the legislators are at great risk, you know, and I'm probably telling the whole world about it, but I think there needs to be something done about this, because we're all at extreme risk because our signatures are on the Internet related to the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitson, I agree, and I'll talk in just a moment about a couple of options that we're going to queue up to help on this in this regard. As to what we are doing, we are continually evolving our business rules. As new attempts and new methodologies for fraud come up, we share that information with other states, and other states share with us, and so that's a big help to us to be able to program into our system filters that would kick these returns out for manual review. But we have two proposals that we're going to talk about this time that we think have a chance of helping in this regard. The first is the use of Thomson Reuters, what's called big data, these big data sets. There are companies that have all kinds of personal information and data on all of us. And there is a module that fits right into Gentax, that Gentax, the new system that we're implementing with the core system replacement. And what it'll do is it will score the fraud attempts or the refund requests based upon the likelihood of them being fraudulent. And right now, our business rules do that in a quasi manner, but it either hits the business rule or it doesn't. If it hits a business rule, then it kicks it out for manual review. What this will do is this will score the likelihood out of all of those business rules for the likelihood of a particular return being fraudulent. The other thing that this option does that I think is kind of exciting is it gives the option for us to build in an identity quiz, an online identity quiz. A couple of years ago, I purchased some property in Arizona, and because it was a long distance transaction, I did a bunch of it by internet. I did a bunch of it online. And what the company did to verify my identity is they used one of these companies, either Thomson Reuters or LexisNexis or one of the big companies that has these big data sets, to verify my identity, in that they sent me a quiz. And one of the questions that I remember they had on there was, which of these addresses did you live at? It had house numbers, and they had five or six house numbers, and one of them was 1534. Well, I lived at 1534 Southeast 40th 25 years ago, and they had that information. And the people that are trying to perpetrate this fraud aren't going to have that information, and they're going to fail at those quizzes. And so this I think is a good option for us. Now, we'll have to be judicious in the way we roll that out if we're successful in getting this, because we may ask something as innocuous as, what county do you live in? And legitimate refund filers may not be able to answer that question. And so we'll have to try to find a balance between asking questions that are good enough to be able to fraud or to screen against the fraud attempts, but make sure that the legitimate refund filers get their refunds. So that's one of the options. The other option that we're hoping to get is a real-time withholding match during processing. And what this is it would be to match with Department of Employment data. Right now, employers are required to send information to the Department of Employment, certain information on federal wages and withholding. What we're proposing is that they expand that a little bit and also collect Oregon wages and Oregon withholding. And what this will enable us to do is to be able to match against that particular database in real time as we're processing the return, and to be able to verify the amount that they're claiming as withholding for Oregon purposes. We've chatted with a couple of the payroll companies that supply this information, and right now they say that this would be very easy for them to supply because they collect that information now, and they actually mask it before sending it over to DOE. So from their standpoint, it would be pretty easy for them to get. From our standpoint, it would be tremendous. Now, I have to mention that neither of these is going to be an ironclad guarantee that we're going to stop fraud. There still will be fraud that gets through, but it'll help. But what we're hopeful on this is that the fraudsters will see this much like an alarm system on a home. If I'm a burglar and I want to do nefarious things to a house, then, and I've got two houses to choose from, one has an alarm system, the other one doesn't, maybe the other one just has a locked door, I'm going to go to the one with the locked door. And that's not good for the other states, but I don't particularly care about the other states. I just care about Oregon. It'll just give us an additional defense here. Next one that...
Excuse me. Before you go on, mm-hmm. and don't answer this question if you think there's a security issue involved in it. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just a few days ago indicating that one of the big service providers for filing of income taxes,
yes,
has been breached, and the article mentioned that 19 In addition to the federal government, 19 states had found that fraudulent returns had been filed through that system. At this stage, do you know whether that's whether Oregon's one of those states or not?
Mr. Chair, we were one of those states. I can speak to it. I think much of this has already been out in the newspaper. There was a large provider that actually one of the states, one of the Gentax states, noticed some anomalies. Maybe they had this LexisNexis module add-in. I don't know, but they noticed some anomalies, and they notified the other states. This would have been, I think, beginning of February 3rd maybe, we were notified about it, and what we did was we stopped processing returns, the refund returns, immediately until we learned a little bit more about it. We had a teleconference with all of the impacted states, or all of the states that thought they might be impacted. That next day, we learned the specific fact pattern that the other state had identified. We went back through our records to see if we could identify that particular fact pattern. I think all in all, we have probably reviewed 10,000 returns that we wouldn't have reviewed otherwise. We found some additional fraud, but we didn't find much that fit that specific fact pattern. But I have to say that just yesterday we got a list from that provider of all of the identified names of people that had been used for this particular scheme. There were 861 names on the list, and we scanned through and found out that we had issued refunds to 43 of them. So we did get hit. 39 of those were before we got notified. So whether they stopped or whether they were just filing early, which is a typical method of operation for these, so they want to be able to get in before the real person files. So they do tend to file early. But so whether we stopped it because of our additional scrutiny or whether they had stopped filing, we don't know. But we did get hit. Now I think I heard that we had issued $63,000 in fraudulent refunds based on this scheme. We covered about 23,000 of that before it went out through various methods. So we wound up losing about $40,000 through that particular scheme. It's out there. And this is just the attempt du jour.
And we think the data breach occurred at the vendor?
Well,
or do we know?
We don't know. That's speculation. The vendor is denying it, but there are certain characteristics about the scheme that makes people think that it almost had to have been through a breach of the vendor.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oops. I don't know how to back up. There we go. Property valuation system. The Department of Revenue is responsible for valuing large, complex properties for property tax purposes. And I'm speaking of the centrally assessed properties in the large industrial properties, properties over $1 million in value. And I've got this slide in here just to highlight the importance of the property tax to us in Oregon. Now, I want you to blur your eyes a little bit and not look so much at the numbers. The numbers are based on forecasts and recent spending patterns. But what I want you to see is the difference between the blue parts of the stacked bar that are provided by the income taxes and the red parts that are provided by the property tax. And I've broken this out a little bit differently than what you normally see the property tax. Normally when we talk about where the property tax goes, we'll talk about so much going to cities, so much going to counties, so much going to education, so much going to special districts, but that doesn't really tell the story. The services that the cities and the counties and the special districts supply are similar to the services that we're interested in, the big blocks of services that we're interested here in Oregon, namely education, human services, and public safety. And so you can see that a large part of those big blocks of services are provided by the property tax. So just a reminder of how important the property tax is to us. For the challenges in our property valuation section, stop me if you've heard this story before, but we rely on old technology. We have a handful of people who support that technology back home that are getting near retirement. They're disparate systems, and we rely on spreadsheets that aren't very well integrated, and the workload is increasing. So if this sounds like the same problem that we had prior to the income tax systems to you, you would be absolutely right. The benefits of the property valuation system are, like for the income tax system, there is a commercial off-the-shelf system for property valuation. In property valuation, these are called CAMA systems, or computer-assisted mass appraisal systems. All 36 counties in Oregon use one, and we're proposing that the same option for the Department of Revenue. And so that's one of the things we're queuing up. I think I'll move through these others pretty quickly. We have a shortfall in the funding stream, the CAFA funding stream, that funds at least a portion of our evaluation section. And so we're working with Ways and Means staff on trying to identify the best option to take care of that. The property tax deferral, I think this committee knows better than any in the legislature that there's been considerable work on that over the past four sessions. And the eligibility for the property tax deferral has tightened down considerably. And it's also increased our workload considerably, because part of the work that you did to save the program from insolvency was to implement a recertification process for applicants every 2 years. And so those recertifications go into the Department of Revenue, and we have to process them. They are challenging for us to do. We have to do half of them every year, and we do the other half the next year. And what we're proposing here, or what we're asking for, is one permanent position and six seasonal positions to help us process the applications. We also changed, or the legislature changed last session, the 911 program. We talked about that a few moments ago. And what we really need here is positional authority to process and enforce. We got an increase to the cap, but we need one position to be able to process the returns and another position to be able to audit the returns, as was provided for in the bill. I have a potential personal income tax kicker rebate down here, and you'll see that there's no package number for that because we're not asking for any dollars for this. The reason I put this in here is because I've gotten several questions how much it would cost us to implement the kicker this time. If you remember last time we had a kicker, it cost the Department of Revenue about $1 million to issue those refund checks. This time, if there is a kicker, and I guess we'll all find out tomorrow if we're a little bit closer to that, if there is a kicker, it won't cost us anything because it's a credit on the return now. That is all of the enhancement packages that we're asking for. I did want to touch on this because this was a special project that you gave us last session. You gave us 31 positions and $3.8 million and asked us to return to you $33.1 million in that in increased enforcement. And this is just to let you know that as of December 31st of this last year, we're about 88% of our way to the goal, so we should meet that. And that's what I had for you today. You can take questions.
Very good. Question. The director is here. Now's your chance. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are we going to have another presentation on the core issues, or
yes,
is this our opportunity? So we wait for that.
Yes, yes, we will.
In detail.
Yeah, in detail, which, of course, is a really great idea. Are you sticking around for that?
I am.
Great. So we'll have a chance to talk about that with you, as well as the people who have been directly involved in it.
So another question then.
Please, go ahead.
So I guess the question you must be answering in Ways and Means is, do you have enough money to do your job the way you want to do it? So, do you? Are you asking for, do you have some constraint in mind that prevents you from asking for how much you need, or are you just going in and saying, this is what we need to do our job as well as we think we can do it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I have asked that question or answered that question several times, and my answer to it this year, or this biennium, is a little bit different than it has been in the past. What I would say first is that there probably isn't a state agency out there that couldn't use more funds, and we're in that same boat, that if you gave us additional dollars, we absolutely would be able to do good things with it. We would be able to impact voluntary compliance and enforcement in a positive manner. What's different this biennium is the implementation of the system. I mentioned at the beginning that this is a big lift for us. And what we're having to do in order to implement the system this time around for personal income tax is pull a number of people out of the personal income tax programs. In many cases, these are the people who would be responsible for the training of the new staff that we would get through enhanced resources. And so what I'm asking is, at least this time around, is to not give us those additional resources, because we wouldn't be able to use them in the manner that we would need to use them in the first place. The second reason is we're in the midst of changing platforms, and so what we don't want to do is train somebody up in the old system and then wind up having to train them immediately in the new system. Lastly, the new system is going to give us new opportunities. The new system is going to change our work. In some cases, we are going to be moving people that are doing a particular function now to something else in the Department of Revenue, because the system is going to be able to automate that particular function. We've heard from other states that have implemented this system that you typically don't understand completely the opportunities that you have for additional staff until you've been through at least one processing season. So our plan is to implement the system and then come back to you once we've had that season under our belt and we've identified the opportunities. Every state that has implemented this particular system has identified additional work that they could do. And I have every reason to believe that Oregon will be in that same boat, that we're going to be able to identify additional opportunities for you to invest in us. And so that's our plan. Not now, but wait, it's coming.
Please, yes.
So I'm sure you'll talk about this in the presentation, but the question would be, how long are we waiting for this to happen? Which I guess we're going to hear about in a minute. But and the other question is, how do you measure our performance as a state when it comes to your job? I know in past years there's been numbers that show us effective rates of collection, effective rates of the different areas where we're trying to make sure people pay their taxes. Is all this waiting for this new system to come online and then we can ask it these questions, or can you now share with us, when you go in and say, wait, first of all, is the time hurting us that we're waiting? And secondly, when we're done waiting, what measures will be available to show us how well or not we're doing when it comes to your job?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the wait is essentially one season. And we've implemented the corporation excise tax system this year, and so we may be able to come back after a year's worth of processing and be able to identify some opportunities for you. This is the experience that we've heard from other states, and we have every reason to believe that would be accurate for us as well.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
Which season? Can you give us a time? What space of time are you talking? Is it 015? Is it 16?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, for corporation, I suspect it would be 16. Now, corporation is a little bit messier than personal income tax, because personal income tax, most people file within a specific period. Corporations have different fiscal years, and they file all throughout the year. And so it may be a little bit more difficult for us to capture that information that we need for them, but we expect that we'll be able to come back with you to you next session with some opportunities. It will be 2 years for I think, the income tax system before we can come back to you with those opportunities. 1 year to implement, 1 year to see what the implementation has done or what opportunities there are, and then we'll be able to put something together for you. To the question about how we measure, I think that I'll defer that to Eric, because there are metrics within the system, easy metrics within the system that do measure the capability of states and how well we're doing. So,
yeah, please. Yeah.
So I have this right. This year, 2015, we're still on the old system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, we're on the old system for the personal income tax. We're on the new system starting in November for corporation excise tax.
And the follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the issue would be, is there factored in somewhere to the cost of our system that which we might lose by virtue of just in collections, by virtue of the transition to the new system? That's a quicker way of getting to my point than suggesting that we had to measure our performance against what other states might be doing. So let me just ask, are we accounting for what we might lose by virtue of this transition when it comes to collections?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, when we went into it, when we went into the implementation, we fully expected to lose something. We didn't know what that was, because there is a learning curve to the system. To any kind of a large system conversion, there is a learning curve, and we expected that. I think Gary Humphrey of our corporation section might be able to speak to that. One of the things that we actually found out is that there may have actually been a short-term revenue bump in the corporation excise tax program, simply because we were working hard to clear out what we had in our legacy system to make the conversion to our new system easier. He'll be able to speak to that a little bit more. And it may be that the lag won't happen until this year. Although we were pleasantly surprised at how well the staff have picked up the new system, and so there may not be as big of a lag as what we expected there to be. One of the challenges, and to get to your real question, one of the challenges that we have is that we can measure our direct enforcement revenues, and we can look at them from year to year and look at the changes. We can attribute some of that to the work of the Department of Revenue, but the vast majority of the differences in direct enforcement revenue from the Department of Revenue comes through things that are entirely outside of our control, namely the economy. This last year, we saw a significant decrease in our direct enforcement revenues. This is where the hands-on work that the Department of Revenue does, simply because the economy is recovering. And that seems a little bit counterintuitive, but when the economy first started to go south, we saw a large increase in self-assessed debt that wasn't paid. So these are taxpayers that filed the return. They had some life event happen. They lost their job. Their wife lost their job. They say, I owe this, but I can't pay it. And so that increased the self-assessed debt. That's very easy for us to collect. We can get folks on payment plans and get that to collect. And normally where that would have gone to the voluntary compliance side of the equation, that went into the Department of Revenue's column for direct enforcement revenues. This last biennium, we're seeing the other shoe, and there's been a huge increase in filing enforcement assessments. So these would be the same people, or these would be people who had the same life event, but instead of signaling that I want to comply, but I just can't, these are people that say, I can't pay this, I'm not going to comply. And now we're following up and picking up on those. The filing enforcement assessments, as you might imagine, are much more difficult for us to collect. And so it takes more resource for us to be able to impact those. So there was a bump last biennium. I think outside of our control, there's a little bit of a dip this biennium because the economy is recovering. And I think outside of our control. And there are other reasons, too, I can get into.
Thank you. Yep. Yeah, this is it. I was trying to figure out how we would know and how you could share with us that you know that we're actually failing or doing better. And that's why I was asking you, do we measure our performance against outside other folks, other states that do the same thing or something like it? So I just wouldn't know enough about your system to know how you would know if someone's not paying when they should be, and as we work our way through this transition. That's really a question of how you, whether you're in a position to actually tell us if we're doing well or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we have metrics that we do follow. Each program has metrics. What I'm trying to say is they're fuzzy, and we can't attribute the increases or decreases entirely to the Department of Revenue. So it's like looking through a dark glass, I guess, when you're looking at these figures. You can identify some pieces that we're responsible for, but some pieces we're not. And we do not, I would say, compare ourselves to other states for several different reasons. One, each state has a different baseline that they're starting from, right? And a different enforcement level that they're starting from. I think that overall, there's at least anecdotal evidence that Oregon does a much better job of income tax administration than most other states. And I'd like to pat myself on the back for it, but in reality, it's because we don't have to split the dollars that you give us to sales tax administration and income tax administration. We have much more robust income tax enforcement than virtually any other state. So it's really difficult for us to compare ourselves to other states.
Thank you.
Thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I appreciate it very much. Other questions for the director? Should we go on to core systems?
Yeah.
Paul?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Smith, and I'm the administrator of the Program Management Office for the Department of Revenue. And we're very grateful for the opportunity to talk about the Core System Replacement Project. If I may, I give a brief overview. For some of you, it'll be a refresher, but maybe be the first time some members have been able to see this.
We have four new members.
Okay.
So I think it's important that we bring them up to speed. Thank you.
Yeah, and with me is Gary Humphrey, who will introduce himself in a moment to talk about some of the things that they're experiencing in the corporation tax program with the new system. Touch on quickly just an overview of the project, some of the key business drivers that we've already mentioned, how we did in rollout one. I think the conversation about the effects of GenTax may get to some of the conversation that was just going on, and we're happy to go into some detail with that. Talk a little bit about the keys to how we've been able to be successful to date. Give you a brief update on rollout two. We're already a few months into the second rollout of our four rollout project, and then happy to open it up for questions at any time or at the end. Some of you have seen this slide before. This is a project we've actually been working on since 2009, and the two primary business drivers for this project are to avoid risk and to improve performance. And I'll touch on those in a little more detail in the next slide. We're very fortunate in the Department of Revenue that there are some vendors in our workspace that actually provide solutions to do the work we do. And so we have selected Fast Enterprises, who has a GenTax integrated tax solution and a data warehouse that we're implementing. There are now 20 Department of Revenues in states across the country that have this system. It will replace about two-thirds of our current legacy systems. And the total cost over the life of the project is estimated to be just over $80 million. $65 million of that will be for implementing the system over 4 years. As you can see, we've completed the first rollout on time, on schedule, under budget. On November 12th, we went live with the Corporation Cigarette and Tobacco Tax Programs last fall. We will be doing the Personal Income Tax Program and some others I'll talk about in a moment in this second rollout. The third rollout will be withholding and other programs, and then the final rollout will be some smaller programs. This is a capital reinvestment in our infrastructure. The systems that we have that were built over the last 20 or 30 years, most of them are relatively stable. They're just difficult to support and sustain and to keep up with our current business needs. They're on a COBOL technology, to be a little bit technical. And frankly, we have virtually one or two people left in our building that really understand how some of our core systems work, and they're actually ready to retire, and I think one of them's actually waiting till after this rollout to retire. And so we needed to get into a new platform. Gentax is in a .NET platform, which is a modern technology. You can hire people out off the street, out of college, or with experience from other businesses to work on it. And by going with a COT solution, you can keep it maintained. After we implement, we'll have a maintenance agreement to keep a current version of this system as version upgrades come up or service packs come up, and that'll be part of our ongoing maintenance and support. And so we will always have a current version of the system wherever technology leads us into the future.
COBOL was modern and new about, what, 1965, 1970?
Mr. Chair, I just finished reading a book, or I listened to it on Audible, Innovators, which describes the invention of COBOL in World War II.
Oh, it's even older than I thought. Okay, thank you. So we're a couple generations behind.
Yes. And as Director Buchholz said, we provide the service of generating about $8 billion per year in revenue. And so the infrastructure is critical for that, for the general fund, and that's why we felt it was important to replace it. By the nature of going with a COT solution, we do have opportunities to improve performance. And so we'll talk a little bit about and give you some examples of how we're able to enhance compliance, which could hopefully help our revenue production. Where we can increase efficiency in our operations. We're able to already provide better customer service and self-service for our taxpayers through our new web portal for the programs that were in Rollout 1. And I think this is really important for you in the new system, because it's a system that's a commercial off-the-shelf system that you configure. We should be able to respond to many of your policy decisions much more quickly and more affordably than we were able to with legacy systems. And so that's something we hope to also do. This is just a screenshot of one of many screens in our legacy systems. As you can see, it's the old green screen environment. The challenge with this environment is you need to know where you want to navigate from each screen. You have to memorize two-digit codes to know where you want to jump from screen to screen. We had many systems that were not integrated, some that were, and so sometimes you had to have multiple systems up and jump back and forth between systems. It was a big training curve, and a larger training curve over the recent years, as you have people entering the workforce who have never seen anything like this before in their life, because they're used to an environment that looks more like this, which is what Gentax is. It's a much more intuitive system. You have tabs, and once you learn what each of the tabs contain and the business function for each of those tabs, it's much easier to navigate. And this look and feel is the same look and feel throughout all the different areas in the system, and so it will be easier for us to train our newer employees as they come in to the agency. And this data here, by the way, is just mock data. It's not actual taxpayer data. It gives you a stark contrast between the two worlds we're going from and moving into. If I could briefly just give you an overview of Rollout 1. We have over 1,200 business requirements for all four rollouts, and about 1,100 of those requirements were necessary for Rollout 1. And we were able to meet all of the necessary business requirements for the three programs in our first rollout. We had 14 systems that either needed to be legacy systems that either needed to be retired or modified so they wouldn't recognize transactions anymore for the corporation cigarette and tobacco tax programs, or partially retired. All the legacy systems function. It's not just does the new system function. As you're in transition, do your legacy systems behave the way you want them to? For example, we bank all the money that we get at the Department of Revenue now through the new system. And then we pass through to the legacy systems for the programs that are still in legacy, and then we keep that money in Gentex for the systems that are in the programs that are in the new system.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it says all systems working as planned. We can't let you get away with that. How was your plan, good or bad, or what was your plan?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Vitz, that's a good one. We actually do have, and this is an opportunity, actually, to compliment our team. We do have 5 vendors working on the project right now. One of them is a solution provider. One of them is a quality assurance firm who reviews our business plans, our project management plans, our cutover plans. We have 2 firms that help us with managing the project. And one of those firms, who's our project advisor and has been doing this for 30 years, says that our plans are some of the best plans they've ever seen. I think that's because we had a delay in the project. We started at this in 2009. We came at this again in 2011 and then 13. We finally got approval. But that period between 2011 and 13, we were really able to invest in good planning. And I think that foundation has really helped us. And so I would say I think it's because we have good plans that we've been successful. And according to the good plan, we were able to measure against the systems and retirement.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. So this is obviously, I got here in 08, so I've been able to watch the thing evolve, as a bunch of us have, and so I recall those plans. I honestly do, and it's very interesting to see the evolution, and it's great to see it working the way you have planned.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, thank you.
So there are advantages every once in a while for the legislature to be slow and deliberate.
Mr. Chair, you are correct.
There are a few days when I think that this may be one of them.
Mr. Chair, Jim Buchholz, Director of your Department of Revenue. I would say, just briefly, I was disappointed when we didn't get approval in the 12th session. I thought we were ready. In retrospect, not getting that approval was a gift, because that year, particularly the year in 2012 until 2013, was where we really laid the foundation that led to the success. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may continue, one of the other things that we're trying to do is avoid customizing the COT solution. And for the programs in Rollout 1, we've been able to do that. I don't know that we'll be able to do that for all of our programs, because there may be something unique in some of them that we just need to do some customization. For example, one of the things that we were thinking we were going to have to customize was for taxpayers to enter the e-portal to transact with us. Originally, the vendor had single-factor authentication, and our standard was already dual-factor authentication. And so we said, we will customize if we have to do that. And the vendor said, we will just make that a part of the core, and so now that's available to all the Gentex states. So to date, we haven't had to customize anything, and we've been able to just configure the system to do our business.
Of course, that turned out to be sort of the standard, didn't it, for security purposes?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, that is the current standard for that. Yeah. So went live on schedule, as I said, and the last thing I'll mention is we're continuing to operate under budget for this first biennium. And here's where we can maybe have some conversation about the impacts and the effects of Gentex. We converted a lot of data, and that's one of the biggest risks with a project like this, is how much data you have to convert, and then will it behave the way you want it to in the new system? You spend an enormous amount of time working on that data. We converted over 126,000 customers in our first rollout, almost 130,000 accounts, over 400,000 returns, and over $4 billion in tax liabilities in the first rollout. And we were able to convert those and reconcile from our legacy system to the new system to the penny on the tax. And it's because we practiced over and over and over again. That's one of the benefits of FAST and their methodology, is we practice converting the data to see that it's going to behave the way you want it to in the system. Converted data, and Gary may mention this in a little bit, behaves differently sometimes than native data. If you process a return in the system and it's all native from the very beginning through the end, the system will work fine. But when you're converting data from a legacy system into the new system, it takes a lot of work to make sure it'll behave the way it should. How do we know the system's working? As I mentioned, we've processed all of our payments since November 12th. We've banked almost $600 million in the new system and passed $554 million to our legacy system programs, and $50 million have been corporate cigarette or tobacco tax program revenues. Almost 600 users in the agency have signed on to the system to use it. We've issued over 21,000 notices to taxpayers. Over 500 taxpayers have registered online through our e-portal, and that's with a soft launch as we're getting the word out about the services that are available to them. We've issued over 1,700 refunds, and so the system is working. The things that we used to do in our legacy system, we're continuing to do with the new system. And it's a system, as I said, that's in 20 other states. But what I'd like to do is ask Gary Humphrey to maybe share a little bit about the experience that he's had as the corporate tax manager for the department.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Humphrey. I am the Corporation and Estate Section Manager at the Department of Revenue. So, yes, we were the rollout. The biggest program, I guess, in rollout one was the corporate excise income tax programs. As we've been talking about, I mean, we're processing returns, corporate returns, through Gentax. We're accepting payments. We're issuing refunds. We're conducting audits. We're doing filing enforcement work on non-filers. We're doing collections work on accounts that need to be done. All of that's being done in the new system now for the corporate program. And going back to this slide that you have in front of you, a little bit. On the real-time processing, some of the functionality that's described here, we're able to do things a little bit quicker in terms of processing. So we would, before, you know, we'd batch returns and then run them through maybe once a day through processing. We're able to do that quicker now. It's basically an ongoing process where returns come in and we're able to batch what we pull and process it. We don't have to wait to the end of the day. This risk scoring refund review is really talking about internally, as we're looking at refunds and determining how many levels of review that may need to have, what kind of review needs to take place, we're using more of a criteria-based, a risk scoring method now to determine what needs to be reviewed. Before, our legacy systems, you know, you might review a lot of refunds that were there really wasn't much to look for in terms of issues. It was very clean cut, but we would spend quite a bit of time reviewing. So now we've introduced a little more complex process to look and determine how many levels of review needs, what we need to look at in that review process. So, for example, I mean, if there's been more manual interaction, employee who has done something on the account, abated, moved payments, whatever type of thing, then that is going to introduce more review to happen than maybe if it's not. If it's just a very clean return comes in, all the payments are there. So it's a different review process. When we talk about viewing the exact copy of correspondence, any notices that go out now or letters from the system, the employee can easily pull up on Gentax and see exact copies of what went out. That wasn't something you could easily do in the prior system. So we can see. So if somebody calls in, has a question, we can easily pull up the notice that they received and walk through it with them, see what's there. On the online services, we've got ability for taxpayers to come on, look up their account balance to see where they're at, to make payments, to view the correspondence. So if they have lost something that we sent to them, a notice or a letter, that they can sign on. So Eric mentioned there's over 500 that have registered on Revenue Online so far. They can go in and look up any correspondence, notices that we may have issued. They can file a power of attorney or authorization to represent can be done on the system. They can file appeals on the system now with us. So in our internal process, when they if they object to something we've done, they can do that through the system. And I believe they can also do penalty waiver requests because we will look at penalty waiver if there's penalty involved. So those are some of the online services available. The multiple screens, the drill down, Eric showed you a copy a little bit ago.
Too far back.
Too loud, my echoing.
He's too close.
So on the screen itself, he showed the different tabs. So now we're in one system, and there's just a whole lot of information in one place, and then there's several different tabs to look at. So we're learning where to go to find the information. Most of it's pretty intuitive, but there's a lot there, and we're able to just click and find what we need as we work through whatever we're doing, audit or helping a taxpayer. We can view original and amended returns, so the employee can pull up the return itself, something I really appreciate when I'm reviewing a refund or something that I can pull up and look at the return to see what was filed, and then look and see what we've done, if anything, to adjust that and see if it looks appropriate. The taxpayer can also go on and see the return filed with us if it's one that's been filed through Revenue Online, which right now would be just in our tobacco and cigarette programs. They can file on Revenue Online. For corporation, they still file through an e-file system, Fed State, piggyback with the IRS, and it's sent to us. So those returns the taxpayer can't see on Revenue Online, but they would have their own copy. And then just a little bit about some of the things about CORP, specific to CORP that we're seeing. Case selection. When we're selecting cases for audit, we're finding some definite advantages, some niceties to the new system in terms of what we're able to do to score and identify areas of noncompliance that we think exist on returns and then to select for audit. We can use IRS information. There may be employment information. There's a variety of source information we'll look at that we can use and then score and determine where we think we need to focus our audit. Audit efforts out. There's a feature that we're just beginning to use that's a net operating loss tracking kind of mechanism. You can carry over net operating losses 15 years. And what we're able to do now is to track and log those losses when that loss is first claimed and it's been claimed in carryover years. We're going to be able to track better to see if the appropriate amount of loss has been claimed, or if more is claimed than what was shown on the return. We're still, it's one of those areas when Eric was talking about converted data that we still have to be careful to make sure that our data is good that we have in there before we'd make adjustments, but we're finding that to be very, very useful, and we think it will be for future work. It's also potential exists, we think, to do that for credits in the next rollout, to look at tax credits and be able to track those better as well. We're doing some automation for filing enforcement that we haven't done before. If we have an Oregon corporation, domestic corporation, who hasn't filed, we're kind of stepping up that process, automating some of that process a bit. So when Director Buchholz was talking earlier about potential future resource shifts or how our work may be impacted as we automate certain things, the back end impact may be where we find that now we need resource people to look at things where they did it up front before. And this is an area where we may find that, but we don't know yet what that will look like. One thing about processing, we've had a lot of returns that come in where we suspend just for payment mismatch in our legacy systems. Just one of the main examples that exists, because we have a corporate excise tax and an income tax, but most everyone files the excise tax. I think corporations think intuitively they're paying the income tax, and when they make their payment, they check the box for income tax, and that's where it goes, and then they file an excise tax return, and we have to move the money to the excise tax filer. Well, that's a lot of busy work to do, and so in the new system, we think we've got it set up, and we'll see the results out of this season for 2014 returns. To where when they file that return, we'll move the payments to the return they file if it's excise tax, and it won't require, should not require much manual intervention. Another example is when they have affiliates that they've listed for the company. They'll sometimes make the payment under the affiliate name, and then when they file the return under the name of another one of the affiliates, the parent. And we'll have to move that money. We're also going to automate some of that movement of money also in the new system. So those are some benefits we're seeing in processing. Reporting, I know Eric's going to talk more about number stuff, but there's just a lot more capability for reports that we can look at our desk online, where we don't need to go ask for somebody to query results to get us a report. We're able to look at reports to see how audit, filing enforcement, processing payments, whatever, to kind of see how we're doing. I mentioned some of the challenges, adjustments, converted data, as Eric mentioned before. That's one of our things right now as we transition, when we're dealing with data that we move from the legacy system to Gentax. There's some issues that arise around the data, and it's not native, and so we have to be more careful to make sure that that data is correct. We've made a lot of effort to make sure that what we moved into Gentax was accurate and clean, but even so, there's just some issues that come up around that data, converted data, that present some challenges. And the other is really just getting used to a new system. It's been very good. We're excited about it. I go to meetings with other states two or three times a year, and that use these, or Eric mentioned like 20 that do that. I get to interact with them. Haven't found anyone who wishes they'd have done something different. And so we are just, we're looking forward to learning the system even better, but we're just getting into it for court. So I think that's kind of what I had, unless you have questions.
Okay.
So you've heard a lot of the good things about COT solution, and by and large, the vast majority of things that we're taking advantage of are benefits to us. But when you buy a commercial off-the-shelf solution, you get what you get with the whole package. And there are some things, and we knew this with our eyes wide open going into it, that are different. And one of those that we're working through is how to extract data out of the new system. And it's not that it's difficult to extract the data out of the system. It's just that the data is in different locations. It behaves differently. It's an integrated tax system that is much more robust and sophisticated than we're used to working with our legacy systems. And so as we put our efforts into understanding the data in the new system now, that's the first job. And I said, I think the last time I was here, we had a conversation about this. I said, for the programs especially that straddle in each rollout, so for corporate tax that went live in November, you had a majority of data in the legacy systems, but we had a few hundred returns that came in with extensions that were in the new system. And the data is not apples to apples in the two systems. And so you have to learn what the fields in Gentax mean when you're talking about return data, transaction data, payment data, and to make sure you're extracting the data out of the new system so that when you're comparing it to the legacy system, you have meaningful information. And that just takes a great deal of time for us to learn that. But we have a suite of tools that come with Gentax and with the data warehouse where we can do a lot of analytics in the system. We just need to learn all the different data elements and the opportunities that we have. And then for some of the functions where we export the data for economic modeling and things like that, we're having to really understand what are the fields, what are the data elements that we want to be taking from Gentax that will be relevant as we extract it. And that is taking more effort, and we knew that going in. We're actually putting a couple more resources to this, and we may need to, from here forward, compared to what we used to do, have more resource trying to understand the data and keep our data mapping current. But that's just the nature of this system. It's more complex.
I hear two things. The first is being able to understand and use the data in both systems. And the second is understanding the way in which the data in the new system is grained differently than in the old system. One of those problems goes away over time, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, correct. Over time, it will. You'll still keep historical information because it's valuable for looking back. But especially as we get several years under our belt and get the native data into the system, it'll become a new normal for us. But for the next few years with each of the programs, and we're paying a lot of attention to this right now with personal income tax. We know how important it is to have our information as quickly as we can out of the new system. It took us a little longer to get the corporate tax data out of the system than normal, but because we're learning it. But we know now kind of what the challenge is, and we're putting the resources to it. But the data's there. It's ours. We just have to understand it to be able to extract it and use it appropriately.
Well, Dr. Warner will be very pleased when he comes to you with questions that we have asked him.
We just ask that you'll be patient. We're going to learn as fast as we can, if we may, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I've already touched largely on the keys to success. We had a great deal of planning. I talked about multiple mock conversions. The only other thing I'd mention is with Gentex, you have a staging environment. So we were able to, towards the last several weeks before we went live, run production data that we had run through our legacy systems for corporate cigarette and tobacco tax programs through Gentex, and have the people who would be using Gentex actually work that data to learn how their job would work in the new system, and see if there were challenges, and we'd do more refinements with data anomalies and how the data behaved. And so the two big factors that I think are helping us be successful is the multiple mock conversions, so we can really refine the data, and two, we can practice using the system in a staging environment that looks just like production for weeks before we go live. So when we flip the switch, it's just another day in the office for us. Briefly, Rollout 2, the programs in Rollout 2, personal income tax, of course, is the big one. Self-employed transit will come in with that. Estates and trusts, senior and disabled deferral, and emergency communications. Those are the five program areas in Rollout 2. We're going to continue to try to avoid customization. We're scheduled to go live this fall. We'll select a go-live date in early March. We're gathering all the data and all the dependencies for what you're doing in your legacy systems, what you're doing in the new system, and what makes the most sense for when to go live, and we should have that date. And the budget looks good for this year, as long as it goes well in Ways and Means. I mean, we got what we needed to get through the 13-15 biennium, but we will need to borrow more money. The bulk of this is funded through bonds, and then there's a small portion of general fund that helps pay for some of the maintenance and support and data center costs. And that is our conversation.
Questions? Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for being here again and giving us an update. It's great to see a project going well like this. Just for my own edification, clarification, and I think for the public's as well, we often think of a new technology upgrade to a system is going to immediately result in efficiencies and reduction of force and all that sort of thing. But I think it's a much more it sounds like it's a much more complex equation that's going on here. Could you talk a little bit about what the advantages you get apart from, well, do you get the efficiency advantages, I suppose, in your personnel, but what are other advantages?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Davis, we will have that conversation in as good a detail as we can in the 2017 session, because we know we're going to see shifts in our resource. Because there is more information available for us to use, we know we're going to have more people involved in data analytics to help us optimize and run our business better. There are other areas, like Gary had mentioned, where we're going to be able to automate some functions that we manually set up now, and so we will have less resource there. We plan to present the legislature, to present you with options and say, here's where we're able to do the same amount of work with less resource. Here are some opportunities to reinvest it. And here's the new footprint for the kind of skill sets we need. We also anticipate we'll probably have to change some job classifications because the nature of their work has changed. And so we'll have a better picture of what that looks like in 2017, but I think we'll probably have an even better conversation by 2019. 2017 will still be early because you're just coming off of your first year of withholding. You haven't got your fourth rollout into production yet. But by the time you come into 2019, we ought to really be humming with corp and personal income tax and even do some more refinements then. I don't know if I answered your question.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all your work on this. We really do appreciate it. Actually, three questions. The first is, you said that it appears that we're on budget. Is that what I heard, that we are on budget, or have things or events occurred in the past 4 or 5 years that have changed that number?
Mr.
Temple, the recent challenge with the hackers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, fortunately, we have separate funding for the project. There's no relationship between the project and our operating budget, with the exception of about, I think, $700,000 or $800,000. There are three staff that are dedicated to the project from the agency, but all the rest of the staff on the project are funded through separate appropriations of general fund or through bond sales. And so we're managing that budget, and we have about $3 million of contingency, too, that you've given us, and we haven't used any of that. And so we have about $5 million that we're projecting by the end of this biennium that we will be to the good for our budget for the project for this biennium.
Second question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, yes.
There's a bunch of legislation that was passed the last go-around in kind of as a follow-up to the Cover Oregon situation, putting DHS in a position of oversight, kind of watchers. Has that, are they watching you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think there's legislative fiscal staff in the room watching us right now. Yes, and we have a good partnership both with the DAS CIO office and legislative fiscal office. They have reviewed a great deal of our project plans. They've reviewed the quality control firm's assessment of our plans. They attend our monthly executive steering committee meetings. We have regular updates, and so there's a great deal of oversight outside of the Department of Revenue on this project, and they've been very valuable along the way. During the season when we had the delay, they gave us a lot of good counsel about some things that we could continue to do to be ready for this project. They've been very valuable partners.
So follow up, please. Final question. So we often pass laws out of this committee. Are you going to have a function of your system that advises us of how much it's going to cost to revise the system each time we pass one of these new laws?
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, Representative Betts, you're talking about the revenue impacts or the fiscal impacts?
The cost of changing the system so it can manage the changes we make in the tax laws.
Yes.
Something that we just talked about yesterday in the reconnect as the federal laws change. Mm-hmm. So there has to be an ongoing cost, which we would add to as we, of course, always improve the system of tax.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we will be able to give you, to the best of our ability, what the costs will be. As again, with the COT solution, hopefully it won't be as expensive to reconfigure the system for things like reconnect. It should just be embedded in our normal maintenance and support costs, and there wouldn't be any additional cost. That's our plan. It would be new programs or new features that are outside the scope of what we currently have contracted to provide that we'd probably come with an additional cost, if I understand your question.
You have.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnson?
No, I'm fine.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I misunderstood the head nod. Anything else for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate, others have already said it, but let me say it too. We appreciate very much several things. One is the thorough report. Two is that you're not regularly in the media. And number three, the reason for your not being in the media. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Keep it that way, Mr.
Chair. Let's keep it that way, yes. That's right. All right. Is there anything else on the information meeting today?
That's it.
That's it. All right. We'll close the information meeting. Colleagues, we do not have any bills for introduction today. We have a few more days during which it's possible to introduce bills under the current system. The committee will be out of the business of introducing bills no later than next Wednesday because of the requirement that any of the special late bills you ask for, you'll have to introduce yourself.
Yep.
So that being the rule. Are we ready to go ahead with the work sessions?
Yes, ma'am.
We are. All right. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2482. Kyle? And Mr. Phillips, in case there are questions, you might want to come forward. I think both of these bills are yours.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Both of the bills, we have 2482 and 2483, do come to us from the Department of Revenue. 2482, just a reminder, it clarifies the assessment responsibilities of the Department of Revenue and county assessors relating to industrial property valuation. It requires the county to appraise property for 5 consecutive years in the case of when the county requests to assess property that would otherwise be state appraised industrial property. This will apply to assessment years beginning on or after January 1st, 2015, and property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015, which is one and the same. It's just those are two different. The assessment year and the property tax year start on different days. So it'd be 2015 is when this starts, July 1.
All righty. Representative Bass, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2482 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2482 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Boy, no discussion. Obviously, the explanation we had a few days ago was an adequate one. I hesitate to ask, is there any objection to the motion? An objection means a no vote. I don't hear any objections, so the motion carries and the bill goes to the floor. I wonder, Representative Smith Warner, if you'd be willing to carry.
Don't let him do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, we appreciate it very much. This should give other new members the warning. Are you ready on the other one? Let's open it, and we'll have a conversation.
Yeah,
all right.
Okay.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 2482, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2483. This one may be a little less smooth. There were some questions about the issue of a unit and what that means. And I think, Representative Bentz, you may want to repeat your question, and let's see if we can get an answer.
Sure. I think actually it's Representative Davis that has the question.
Oh, Representative Davis, thank you.
But I'm happy to phrase it as I understood it, but maybe we'll just let him go forward.
Should we ask him to do it then?
I'm happy to defer to the Vice Chair to begin the discussion.
Then here's the question. The issue is in the value of a unit of property, the challenge to the taxpayer would be if the taxpayer chose to challenge the department's conclusion, and let's assume that this unit broke into parts, maybe let's say 5, and so the taxpayer challenges one part of that decision, then the way this bill is written, as I understand it, the department could come back, because it's a unit, and open up the discussion or the appeal to all the other 4 parts of that unit. And the question we have is, what is the commonality that would allow the department to possibly impose upon the taxpayer a great deal more cost as a result of now not only being able to appeal the one element, but now having to basically argue and maybe have evaluated or appraised the other 4 parts of the unit. So the question is, what is that commonality, and why would we want to put the department in a position where it could impose that type of cost upon a taxpayer who was only interested in raising one part of the decision, if you will, in his or her appeal?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I was actually hoping that you would have passed it on down to Representative Leininger, because I would have had a chance to pronounce her name correctly. But since Representative Davis asked the question and you've asked it for him, I will try to answer to you. I think the best way maybe to answer this is that it's important to remember that a property tax account, is just an administrative thing. It is not necessarily, it can be an arbitrary thing at times. An account is not how property is appraised. An account could represent the fact that that somebody purchased a piece of property at one time in history, another person purchased the one next to it, and then a third person buys both of them. And now this person has 2 accounts, but it's really all one property. And so the way property is valued is as a unit.
And so when you're appraising a unit of property, and that is where the appraisal should land, not on a specific account. The problem comes where you have multiple accounts and you value the unit, and then you have to allocate them between the accounts so that you have tax statements for each one. Now, I think the legislature understood this point back when Measure 5 passed, because if you look at the definition of unit of property in 310.160, which is what I have in front of me here, and there's five different explanations of what a unit of property is, depending on what property we're talking about, whether it's a condominium or a timeshare or a personal property or a farm or a forest, or like an industrial forest land, or maybe a manufacturing operation. The legislature said when you're figuring out where to put the $5 and the $10 limits, those are those limits of Measure 5, they apply to the unit of property. So you're not applying those limits to individual accounts. That wouldn't make sense, because that isn't how property is appraised. So if you say, well, we've got a plywood mill and the glue room has this certain value, it's on its own account, it's only because that amount of money was a value was allocated to that building, not because that building has a value in and of itself. It only really has a value as a part of an operation that brings the wood, the lumber, you know, the trees to the mill. They're chipped, they're brought into a building, they're glued, and they're moved on. So the building is appraised, and then it's allocated. And so what the taxpayer would be arguing would be making more work for themselves, because they would be trying to place a value on something that doesn't have a standalone value. And what the assessor is trying to do is to figure out what the total value is and then allocate it to those accounts because he has to or she has to. Now, this also applies the other direction. So if the assessor feels like one of the accounts, it's the taxpayer or the assessor, it can work both ways. So it puts the onus on both parties to say, what's the correct value for the unit of property?
Yes, please.
The focus is on the unit, then, not the pieces of the unit, as I pose the hypothetical.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Bence.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Davis?
I'm trying to recall, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your testimony. I'm trying to recall the first hearing, and in particular, I believe the assessors were here, and you. What sort of industry or among the tax appeal bar or industry, what sort of response to the bill has there been? Or was this run by them? I guess is my question. Or was it just the assessor community that had a chance to review it, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, this discussion really occurred back in 2007, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I think there was members of the, business community involved at that time, but since this particular change is just aligning it with the way things have changed since legislation in 2012 that broke out more accounts, it was an inadvertent result of that legislation. Industry, we'd had long discussions with industry about machinery and equipment being broken out from commercial property, and that was to benefit commercial property owners because of the way the changed property ratio works under Measure 50. And again, I could get into that, but I think that's why nobody's here to be concerned about it, is mm-hmm. because the policy was decided back then. They agreed that really the unit of property is the concept at which the value should be placed.
Follow up?
Yes, please, yes.
As it comes to the definition of unit, and thank you for bringing up the commercial property owner example, where example you have a building, as is often the case in the commercial landscape, owned by a landlord that's under a ground lease, leased completely to a tenant that has their business equipment in the building. Are those units separated out at that point? Because there you have two separate taxpayers who have different parts of ownership of what might seem to be the same unit. Do you understand the question?
I think I do, Mr. Chair, Representative Davis. I think that's the point of subsection 4 of that statute, where it talks about personal property, where if you have a single owner and a large building with multiple rooms, pardon me, like, let's say, Blue Cross Blue Shield downtown. They've got a large complex. They have a lot of personal property. They would all report that as one unit. Mm-hmm. But where you have a separate ownership, then the personal property would be reported discreetly to that particular owner. So you've got a large building. You say you have a law office in one area, a CPA in another area, a Red Cross facility in another area. You might, what you would have is you would have three separate units there.
So what's it, please?
I don't know if this fits in there, but would it apply to condominiums that are in a single building then?
Do you want to take that one?
Sure. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Whitsitt,
Mark Garst.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mark Garst, representing the Oregon Department of Revenue. Each condominium would be under a separate condominium ownership, and so, yeah, they would each be a separate unit, each house.
Well, let me follow up on that then. Many condominiums are in a single building, and others have common land. Does the corporation, the Homeowners Association Corporation, have its own account unit based on the common ownership values, or is that somehow or another allocated to the individual owners, or do you know? I don't know if that's your question, but it certainly is a follow-up question.
Mr. Chair, I can try to answer the first part of that, and I'll ask Mark if he can the other. I'm not an appraiser myself, so I do hesitate to get into the detail of appraisal deeply. But with the condominium units where you have different owners, that those would have their own discrete accounts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you think of an account as being a piece of land and a building. But these accounts, you can have 20 accounts on one floor, you know, and if you have six floors, you have a lot of accounts. And each is owned by somebody discrete and different. They get their own tax statement. And all the value of that account is rolled up into their tax statement, and that's considered the unit. As far as the common areas, though, I'm not exactly sure how that happens.
Right, the fabric of the building itself, the hallways, the surrounding land that, generally speaking, are held in common by the condominium corporation. Do they have their own separate account? Or do they somehow or another parceled out to the owners of the individual units?
Chair Barnhart, I've done some appraisals myself of condominiums, and typically you'll have the pool, for instance, will be under the ownership of the condominium association,
right.
And then the condominium units will have some interest in it, but I think that you would have the condominium association in that case appealing the common areas, and then an individual owner would still be able to appeal the value of just their condominium unit.
And this this proposal, 2483, will not change that system. I mean, in the case we're talking about, a unit would be the common land, common property, and another unit would be the individual condominium units that have separate owners.
Chair Barnhart, I don't believe that it would. And the only, I'm trying to think of situations where it could. Maybe if you had a building that was under construction and the developer still owned all the units.
Well, that would be different.
You could argue that that was, at that point, one economic unit. But once they're sold off, I don't think that the effect would change at all.
Yes, please. Yes.
One thing in Eastern Oregon we have sometimes are large ranches that are broken up, and then they're sold, pieces of the ranch, for somebody to build a home on. But they're still part of a huge ranch. And I was just wondering, is the same thing apply for those situations? Like, you may have a 1,000-acre ranch, and then you get, 20 owners that have 50 acres each or whatever. And so how does that work? There's still one overlying group that owns the ranch, though, and the ranch common lands are farmed or ranched. I mean, I'm just trying to understand, does this affect that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, it really gets down to how the property is appraised. If those people that own those individual homes have their own account and it reflects their home, then they're going to get their own tax statement, and they can appeal the value if they disagree with it. But if that home somehow contributes to a operating unit of the ranch, I can't see how that would be brought into it because it's under different ownership. So what really this legislation gets at is more like a commercial or manufacturing, an operation that someone says, well, I think my machinery and equipment, or I think the value of building Z is wrong, and so I'm going to appeal that. But when the property is appraised as a whole operating unit. And so to the extent, I guess I'd have to explore the ranch question more. I don't know the nature of the ownerships that you're talking about. I don't have any personal knowledge of what those scenarios might be. We could certainly call a Grant County assessor and ask. But the concept here is that if you've got an operation like a mill or a commercial facility, it's how is it appraised? And then it's a single appraisal.
Yeah, other questions?
I think, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
I think we're in discussion right now, isn't that correct?
Yes, we've opened the work session, and at this stage, there's no motion before us. We're discussing the bill and its general merits, and so this is the time for questions and discussion. Yes.
So I have a discussion rather than a question. I'm looking up the definition of unit, ORS 310-160.
Yes.
And sub 5 of that speaks to the situation of divided ownership that I brought up earlier.
Yeah.
In the case of land upon which an improvement is located, the land and improvements owned by different persons and operated as a single operating unit, the unit of property shall consist of an entire improved parcel, but it would be broken up into multiple accounts between separate taxpayers. Mm. And I think for that reason, I'm not yet comfortable with where we're at with this bill.
Representative Bentz, go ahead. Yeah.
You know, I just want to ask a question of John. See if I have this right. The whole thing is the unit. You're trying to get to the value of the unit. Now, it may be made up of a number of different accounts, but you have to look at the whole, and so the definition has 4 or 5 takes at what units might be, different situations where, well, this is going to be a unit. But the idea, the thing we're trying to get at is the value of that unit. Now, you might break it into pieces, separate accounts, but that you couldn't really determine the value of one without looking at the value of the whole. So to avoid perversion of the situation, you wouldn't want to allow necessarily someone to challenge one account, because you can't really get where you're going without taking the other account, assuming a two-account situation. I hate to say it, into account. But anyway, the point is it's all about the unit and getting to the correct value of the unit. Is that what this is about, to make sure we don't allow people to cherry-pick one part of it, argue it, and then maybe by design leave the other account unadjusted by virtue of whatever the outcome of the appeal of the first account might have been? Is that what you're about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that's exactly it, and said much better than I've said. Exactly.
Maybe not.
Representative Leininger?
So I want to try to make sure I understand, and I also want to give you a chance to say my name correctly. So say you have a manufacturing operation, and it's owned by a few different holding companies, and so they each might, you know, own a piece of the campus, right? What is the evil that we're kind of trying to prevent against one in which one LLC owner says, darn it, you know, my manufacturing bay was overvalued, right? Because they're never going to want to say it's undervalued. Mine was overvalued, so they call upon you to do a reassessment and reduce by a few million dollars the value of the manufacturing bay. And then your sort of comeback, this provides your comeback, which is, all right, well, maybe it's worth a few million dollars less than we thought initially. However, the aggregate value of the manufacturing operation, the campus with all of its elements, real property and personal property, is still what we thought it was. I mean, is that kind of the conversation that is had, that this bill enables you to have a comeback for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, yes, that's it. And to the extent you try to, as Mr. Representative Benz was talking about, to the extent you try to break up how the property is looked at from the market's perspective, you break that up from that perspective, then you're really talking about, was the allocation done correctly? Mm-hmm. And so there can be disagreements about that. And even if the parties, which has happened, agree on the total value of the operation, they may disagree on how it's allocated.
Yes.
I have a follow-up. Yeah. So there's no opposition to this? I mean, I can imagine scenarios in which it would be to the disadvantage of some business owners, but if people feel like in net it just makes, irrationalizes the system, I'd be willing to accept that. But is there really no pushback on this? Or is it so arcane that no one knows?
Chair, Representative Leininger. There are a few tax representatives who are aware of this kind of thing because they employ it to lower the value for the taxpayers.
Yeah.
But the thing you should not fear, I would recommend, is you should not fear getting the correct market value on an operating unit.
Right. I'd like to parse the bill against the definition that's in the bill, because I think it's important for us to understand how this bill and the existing statute 310.160 fit together. And if you'll indulge me for just a minute, let me do that. The bill says that we're talking about accounts that constitute a unit of property within the meaning of this statute. So then we go to the statute, and there the statute says, the unit of property to be considered shall consist of all contiguous property that is used and appraised for a single integrated purpose, whether or not the property is taxed as a single account or multiple accounts. That's the basic definition of a unit within the statute 310.160, which is referred to in the bill. And then in the second section, it goes through a bunch of specialty assessments, and it lists a bunch of them. And then it says, or any other law. And there, a unit of property shall consist of all components of land and improvements in a single operating unit. So that's three words, single operating unit, become the key to that piece. Number three, in the case of timeshare properties, all real property components associated with all timeshare property with a timeshare plan is described in. So what they're trying to do there is to make sure that a house that's in a timeshare will actually be appraised as a whole property, not as what the 2 weeks is worth that you bought. Number four, in the case of personal property that's not part of an operating unit of both real and personal property, so the real property and the personal property are somehow or another not part of a operating unit, the unit of property shall consist of all items of personal property identified in a single property tax account. So there's a specific exception to that one piece. And then number five, which is the last piece, in the case of land upon which the improvement is located, and the land and improvements are owned by different people, if the land and improvements are a single operating unit, there's those three words again, the unit of property shall consist of the entire improved parcel, and that means both real and personal property, my editorial comment. At first, when I looked at this, I thought this was a mess, but as I parsed my way through these five subcomponents, I realized how the whole thing fits together actually quite nicely. We're not actually using the specific, the definitions within 310.160 for the purposes that the statute itself was originally written. We're using it only for the definition of unit. And when you look at only the definition of unit, it's consistent all the way through for what a definition of a unit is. And of course, what I understand, and please help me if I've misstated this, what has happened apparently is that in the process of allocating a unit's value to the various tax accounts that it's made up of, the allocations done by the appraiser overvalued some portions, some accounts, and undervalued others. When you add them all together, they equal the value of the unit. So what's happened is that Wiley lawyers, well, we're all Wiley, I guess, aren't we, by definition, Wiley lawyers have come along and said, well, I'm only going to appeal the account that they overvalued. I'm not going to appeal the others because, of course, I'm not going to appeal anything that's undervalued. And so you end up with the department stuck in a position in which the value of the unit is undervalued because the appeal process led to a change in the value of that one account. Now, is that really what we're aiming at here?
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
So that when that situation arises, the department or the taxpayer can say, no, no, I want the whole thing evaluated together. And if you change the value of this account, then maybe you'll change the value of some of the others mm-hmm. so that the unit value is the same as it was, or at least whatever the court found, or the appeals group, whatever that was, found to be the real market value of the unit as defined in 310.160.
Correct.
Have I got that close?
Mr. Chair, yes.
I mean, this. When I sat down here this afternoon, I was concerned about this. I'm not concerned about it anymore. Representative Bentz, did you have something you wanted to add?
Nope.
Okay. All right. Yes, okay, Representative Wetzit, please.
I'm still confused. So if you have a golf course, operates as a golf course, but you've got houses around it, and they're varying expenses, expensive, some are less, some are more. You lump all those in together when you're, if it's operating as a golf course, no.
May I take a whack at that? If I read the statute correctly, okay. If all those houses are owned by the golf course and they're all part of its system of operation, I mean, they rent houses for people who are going to play golf and it's all part of their business operation, then it would be a unit. But if I own one house and you own another house and the golf course is owned by Golf Course Inc., it's just a separate house, then they're not a single, they're not a, what is the language here? They're not a
unit.
Chair Barnhart, common ownership
They're not. Well, they first place are not common ownership, but in the last place, they're not a single operating unit, which is the consistent definition of a unit all the way through that other statute. Because you operate your house without regard to the golf course, and therefore it's not a single operating unit with the golf course.
But that's not a personal. I mean, I'm trying to make an operating unit. Meaning it does something specific, but you're saying it's just an individual unit. Can be personal property in the middle of commercial property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wetzit, if I understand your question correctly, right, you can have your home mm-hmm. on a lot, and it's the unit. That's the unit. Okay. Your lot might be divided by an account. I mean, you might have two accounts and your home might sit across the line. They're not. No one's going to appraise your home as being split. It's going to be appraised as a home. So if you've got a golf course, then you're going to look to the definition and it says common ownership. So to the extent you've got a golf course with 100 homes around it that are owned individually, mm-hmm. then you would individually appraise those homes. They'd be the unit individually. If that's helpful.
Okay. Are we ready to work the bill, or do I need to hold it over? I'm perfectly happy to do either.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I was planning on voting against it because there is some more research I'd like to do about this bill. If you want to hold it over, that's fine,
well,
or I can vote against it.
I have no problem. We're past our time for the day. I'm perfectly happy to roll this over until Monday? Would that work for you? Mm-hmm. Can we do that? Paul?
And can I put the two specific issues that I'm concerned about on,
yeah,
on the
please,
record?
Yeah, please put that on the record now, and then do your research and come back and tell us what you
Absolutely.
Find
so
on
two,
Monday.
The two specific questions are, first, under sub 5 of ORS 310.160, where a single unit of properties does not have contiguous ownership. And we have two separate owners. We have one example where we have associated businesses. There are plenty of examples without associated, the landlord and tenant example that I gave. I'm concerned about the implication of a tenant or landlord appealing an account and the other party who was not a party to that appeal getting pulled into an appeal that they don't want to pay for or be a part of because the department or an assessor has the ability to bring the entire unit into an appeal. So that's maybe a law of unintended consequences that I want to try to avoid. And the second is simply we've only I, want to say thank you to John and the department, because I read the testimony from the public hearing, and you had run it by NFIB and some business organizations. Since I have only come to maybe understand this bill in the last 5 minutes, I venture they may not have understood it, nor had someone with expertise look at it. I do know a couple of practitioners who do property tax appeals that I'd like to just run it by and get their thoughts on. So, thank you.
Right. And just a quick comment. There are lots of commercial buildings with multiple tenants. I'm assuming, and you please come back on Monday and tell us, that you don't consider that building with multiple tenants to be a single operating unit. But if your assessors tell you otherwise, I'd really like to know that, because I might have the same concern that Representative Davis has.
Right. Got it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we will hold this. Paul, did you want to?
I just want to remind you about tomorrow.
Thank you. Let me close the work session on House Bill 2483 and let you know. Remember, tomorrow morning, 8:30, we have been invited to sit with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to hear the revenue forecast. Mm. So they'll stick us on the edge. But if you're here, Chair Haas will recognize you for questions or comments. If you're not here, it will be, of course, because you're busily at work on another committee. Anything else for today?
No, Mr. Chair, just to remind the committee also that we'll be meeting again at 1 o'clock at our regular
time. We will meet at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. This does not allow you, tomorrow afternoon's meeting. All righty. All right. And with that, we are adjourned.